I love you, but I don't like what you did, right? I need to guide you to making better choices, but that doesn't change how much I'm attached to you and appreciate you and love you. And you might talk sternly, but then hug the child afterwards. And that's very similar to what we see in the dog training world. If somebody talks about, you know, I know my dog doesn't really like to be on leash, but I need them to be on leash because it's safer.
Hello everyone, and welcome to Episode 7 of Dog Lab. This is Brian Burton. Today we are investigating human-canine coevolution, and specifically the role pet dogs currently play in our families. I think for most of us long enough in the tooth, we have seen a dramatic shift in the roles dogs play in our families, and the expectations we place on them. While I live in New York City now, growing up in Nova Scotia, I can rarely remember people walking their dogs on leash, and certainly not bringing them to restaurants and birthday parties, but I can clearly remember neighborhood dogs following us to the ball field or frozen pond to take part in our pickup games of baseball or hockey. I can also remember certain dogs who would chase and bite us if we weren't quick enough biking past their house. Dogs certainly had a lot more freedom and autonomy, but also dealt with more risk and less attention to species-specific needs. So in Western societies, how are pet owners now approaching pet parenting? And what effects, good or bad, does this have on pet dogs? And what are we seeing in countries like China and India, where the opinions and cultural attitudes towards dogs as pets are changing? That's what Dr. Shelley Volsch is here to help us with. Dr. Shelley Volsch is an anthrozoologist in the Department of Anthropology at Boise State University. Using a biocultural and evolutionary lens, she studies our ever-changing relationships with non-human animals, particularly dogs. Her current projects investigate the increasing importance of pets as family members, including the application of human parenting strategies to companion animals. This involves consideration of human-canine coevolution, cross-cultural comparisons of pet keeping, interspecific attachment, and the connection between reduced fertility and increased pet parenting. Relatedly, she is interested in how an appreciation of the emotional and cognitive abilities of other species shapes human perceptions of which species are food, foe, or family, and the welfare implications of her influence and uses of these animals. Remember to follow us on Twitter at doglab_podcast and email us any questions or topic ideas to doglab@instinctdogtraining.com. So here is Dr. Shelley Volsch. Dr. Shelley Volsch, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, really excited to have you here, especially after I was able to sort of poke around and look at your research, and you were referred by Dr. Sarah Biozier, who did episode 2. And so there's just a lot to get through in terms of your research and what you're interested in. But I'd like to start here. So just sort of historically, what was the role of the family dog, and why and how is that changing?
Okay. Well, the tricky thing about the role of the family dog is we often think, starting with what's really more of a Victorian era, right? Having breeds, having specific appearances, specific types of dogs. Maybe we have a guarding dog outside, or we have a herding dog that helped us with ranching or tending to our sheep herds. But realistically, our relationship with dogs goes back thousands of years before that. And so when we open up that broader lens, we start to realize that there's a lot of cross-cultural variation in our history with dogs. We know that, you know, as early as 15,000 years ago, there was a burial with a dog that had been, from what we can tell, experiencing distemper. And just the fact that in that kind of pre-settlement, pre-Neolithic era, we had people taking care of pets and giving them special burials. I mean, to have survived with distemper meant that there was some investment. But that was still relatively unique. They were our partners, but maybe not family members the way that we see them now. And that started to change with industrialization. Pets became, you know, especially in Darwin's day, pets became more of a hobby. They became part of our families in the sense that we would tend to them in a different way. They were no longer just livestock or animals in the barn, and they started to come into our homes. And there's a lot of really great books out there, one in particular called Pets in America that I can think about that talk about some of that early historical transition. And yet, despite that, we still see cross-culturally, you know, a lot of times when I'm looking at articles and I see something like, oh, you know, almost all dogs live in human homes and, you know, they're ubiquitous in human homes. I'm like, well, that's not necessarily the case because of the fact that that's a very westernized or especially American-centric perspective. So we still see dogs in, you know, free-ranging colonies. We still see dogs in environments where they're sharing social spaces, but not yet part of the family. What does seem to be a big trigger for the shift into what I call application of parenting strategies to our pets, which we are seeing more and more since the 2000s especially, seems to be in environments where there's high urbanization. So we're really kind of living on top of each other in some ways, right? It's harder to get your personal space. There's higher rates of education. There's a lot more post-secondary education. Individuals may be choosing or otherwise unable to have children for one reason or another. So their investment in their pet shifts from just a pet to something more. And then just kind of the general having an increasing middle class and upper middle class who have the funds to do this. So I'm a co-author on a paper where we looked at this in a population of college students in Bangalore, India, and we're actually captured that shift occurring where they would acknowledge they have more positive perceptions of dogs in the home than they think their grandparents or parents may have had. They're more interested in eventually adopting a dog. Even though the population itself, you know, we had a little over 300 respondents, and even though there's only maybe a third of them that actually had pet dogs, a large number of them expressed an interest once they had their own home of having a pet dog. The other thing that's really interesting is for the longest time, especially since the Victorian era, it was really about that kind of status of having a purebred, right? The interest in having a specific breed that we could identify. And now we're seeing a return to, whether it's for the health reasons or some other socially acceptable norm, we're seeing a return to wanting to adopt free-ranging dogs and street mutts and that type of thing. And we've seen it here in America, right? That's been going on for a while here. But in India, to see that pushback against this colonial norm that goes back to the early colonial influence from Britain of golden retrievers and Great Danes, and instead you're hearing more of the young individuals saying, I'd like to adopt a dog, and I really want to bring one of those free-ranging dogs I see in the street, right? I want to give them a home. They're changing their moral sphere to include beyond just humans. And so we're looking now, our next step with similar co-authors, our next step is to look at how the role of parenting strategies are being played out in India, particularly in, again, it's urban areas with a lot of education, Bangalore, Bangladesh. You're not going to see this happening in a village population where there still is this kind of, the whole village owns the dog. It's not really a member of anybody's family. It's just there. Whereas now, you know, in the urban populations, you're seeing more of that ownership and investment in caring in a specific individual.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's fascinating. There's so many places to go with that. So with dogs being seen increasingly as family members in these more urban sort of, you know, high levels of education, those types of places, and you looked at these parenting styles. So can you talk a little bit about, like, maybe define parenting styles and what your research has told us about how people are raising their dogs? Like, so for example, I know you talked about authoritarian or authoritative, which I know some people mix up, but they are very different, permissive, and then sort of uninvolved or indifferent. But maybe walk through, like, the different sort of pet parenting, or I guess just parenting styles, and how you looked at it with dogs, and what are the trends that you're seeing?
Okay. So, Well, as far as authoritarian, authoritative, and then permissive, and the uninvolved, indifferent, or sometimes neglectful, within the parenting literature, you know, Baumgrind, I forget exactly how to pronounce the name. They really started this, and it's been used in a lot of different research. There's been a lot of different labs that have kind of started to look at this, but authoritarian being, it's a very high control, low warmth environment. If we think about that very controlling, do as I say, not as I do type of a parent, that's really your authoritarian individual. And in dog training and in our relationships with dogs, that tends to translate to things like, my dog shouldn't be on the couch. That's just not where they belong. And mm-hmm. as a trainer, I was always like, well, why? Right? Mm-hmm. Where did you learn that? Why do you think that's the case? Or the expectation that if I say sit, the dog knows what I mean, they should be sitting. And so it somehow justifies, in a lot of cases, authoritarian parenting styles tend to justify the stern, sometimes even to the extreme of abusive, right, type mm-hmm. of responses. And then authoritative yep. is really more a good balance, high control and high warmth. So a lot of times when we think about like good parenting, and I don't know why I did the things because we're not on air, but habit.
Yeah, she did air quotes for everyone listening. So.
So that idea, you know, when we think about good parenting, particularly in the cultural West, of being able to distinguish action from how you feel about your child. I love you, but I don't like what you did, right? I need to guide you to making better choices, but that doesn't change how much I'm attached to you and appreciate you and love you. And you might talk sternly, but then hug the child afterwards. And that's very similar to what we see in the dog training world. If somebody talks about, you know, I know my dog doesn't really like to be on leash, but I need them to be on leash because it's safer. Right. Mm-hmm. Or the willingness to withhold a treat if the dog isn't sitting, using that like negative punishment a little bit type of a thing. And then permissive really is low control and high warmth, enabling just doing whatever. And we see this sometimes mm-hmm. when we think about children who are having temper tantrums in the middle of Target. And the first thing that the parent does is put the cell phone in their hands to distract them. But what you're really doing is reinforcing that behavior so that they continue to have these temper tantrums in this environment. Mm-hmm. And some of that is just a generational difference. I mean, when I was 6 years old, if I had a temper tantrum in retail, we left, you know, so yeah. there was a little bit more control in that environment. And then uninvolved, you know, really is just low warmth, low control, neglectful sometimes even. And so we see these things play out in people's relationship with their dogs. And in particular, my research had found that I did a study, it was part of my graduate work, and a large number of women responded to a survey looking at their degree of attachment, how attached they were to their dogs, and how that related to how much aversion they used in their training techniques. And we had done a whole kind of pre-survey with professional dog trainers and all these different things that I had collected either in my own experience training or talking to people. Tips they might get from a coworker, tips they might get from a website. And I said, you know, rank these so that we can figure out what is the degree of aversion in using this particular technique. And so after I had that and we had these values, I set it out to a survey. I had a little over, actually close to 600 women responded to their survey. And they rated, you know, they answered questions about their attachment and they answered questions about the type of aversion they use. And we came up with a series of scores. And what we found was in this population, almost 80% of the women did not have children. Many of them were very expressive that they were not going to have children. Very expressive. Three of the women who did not have children living in the home did admit they had older children who had moved out. So there were like three empty nesters, but the majority of the individuals didn't have kids and weren't planning on it. And what we found was that these women, if the more attached they were to their pet, the more likely they were to use an authoritative style, a little bit of aversion. It actually increased slightly. It wasn't permissive, but it wasn't mm-hmm. authoritarian. There was no abuse. And there were no scores of individuals using, you know, hitting, kicking, anything like that. And so it really tied to this idea that we had touched a population of women who were shifting gears and parenting their dogs instead of parenting children. And since then, I've stepped back into just a broader definition of parenting, looking at what we call direct and indirect parenting, or indirect and direct care. So direct care being feeding, holding, grooming, walking, being really involved in the daily survival of that, in this case, dog, but sometimes, you know, we originally look at it with offspring. And then the direct indirect care being the things that you do to provide shelter, to defend the home, to make sure that you're gathering the resources that can then be fed. And in looking at it from this perspective and taking a very kind of evolution, we as a species have evolved to allocare. We have evolved to provide care to those who are not our own. And in our own evolution, it would be within a camp of foragers, we see a lot of caring for our siblings, caring for our close friends' children, exchanging food for babysitting. That's set up in our history. But then as we do less and less parenting, as we have fewer or no children of our own, we're transitioning this deep attachment, this deep investment of time and emotional energy to our pets. I mean, I've talked to people who will leave a first date, even if it's going well, because they get a text message that their dog isn't feeling well, right? Which mm-hmm. then tells me that somebody's actually at home watching their dog because they didn't want to leave right. it alone. So,
right. Mm-hmm.
And that's just, that's increasing a lot.
Yeah. And so with these, you said it was 600 women who responded and roughly 80% didn't have children, but you weren't specifically looking for women in the situation. And I'm kind of wondering, like, was there any difference between the people who've had children versus people who didn't in terms of their relationships with their dogs?
So because of the imbalance in the population, we had 20% that weren't that had children. It was a little bit harder to do that statistic. Mm-hmm. And that is something that I'm working on right now with a survey that's going to run for a while, just trying to collect data on who, you know, if you have children, are you doing less of this type of work than if you don't have children? And so we didn't really get to look at that as much as I had hoped. I can say that of the 65% of the sample who identified themselves as either their dog's guardian or parents, the majority of those were the women who did not have children. So I think that language, you know, when I talk to individuals who've chosen not to have children and are in fact calling their dogs, their kids, their girls, my fur babies. And it usually is the individuals who don't have children because that is their outlet. And they're not fooling themselves into thinking like this is a small furry human and it's just the same thing by any means. And I know that that's one of the debates you see show up on social media all the time. But rather it's still that level of mutual negotiation of the relationship and space. These are usually individuals who move more towards that authoritative give and take. They're aware of species specific needs. They don't assume that separation anxiety is something spiteful. They understand that maybe my dog is stressed and I need to get them help. And because they don't have children, they're often more likely to have the resources, the time, the money to invest in that as well.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting too, because of what's important in this is sometimes I feel that people assume that with positive reinforcement training that they're, or people who focus on positive reinforcement or want sort of this relationship with dogs that is, you know, warm, but also we're making it safe. But sometimes I think people feel that positive reinforcement is permissive. Positive reinforcement is a scientific term for increasing probability of behavior. But if we look at the cultural definition of sort of like being positive or using teaching your dog or your kids what to do, but still providing some guidelines and some boundaries and some rules, those types of thing. I think that's a really important point because just because you're working with a positive reinforcement trainer or doing that doesn't mean that it has to be a big free for all. And in fact, I think most of us would agree that that shouldn't be the case. And the nice thing is I feel like most of our clients that come in and most people I deal with are kind of in that sort of, they want to do both, but then sometimes you have people who are a little too heavy on the control and things can lighten up a little bit. And then there's people where like they're giving their dog everything that they need in terms of like the time and the, the resources and those types of things. But really what those dogs need are some, you know, just some, like, for example, a lot of times I tell people who kind of have this problem where maybe their dog has a little too much freedom. It's just like, let's just pick three rules for the house. Any three rules, doesn't matter what it is. It can be, you know, some people, my dogs are up on my couch and I always say, you'll never be able to get my rat terriers out of my bed unless they were biting me. But like, you know, if someone says, you know what, I would like them to not be up on this particular chair. I'm like, great, let's pick that as a rule. Maybe at night they sleep on a bed next to your bed, or maybe when you prepare food, they're not allowed in the kitchen. So they kind of have to stay out. Like, doesn't matter what it is, but sometimes I feel like that picking two or three things to kind of provide that guidance. And I think that taps into as well that the social relationship with their dogs. And sometimes I feel that there's a risk in when we make training so much about the transactions that sometimes we forget about the kind of holistic relationship and the complexity of that and the importance of providing rules and guidance. And, you know, the term leadership has been hijacked by certain, you know, TV dog trainers and certain things. So sometimes you have to be careful, but I mean like real leadership, that you're providing a safe environment, you're providing predictable sort of living situations. And I think that's so important. And that was just something I kind of wanted to highlight there. I don't really know if I have a question on it other than, is that something you sort of see as well or agree with or not?
I definitely agree with it. So as you know, and the listeners are about to find out, I actually used to be a dog trainer before I went back to school to do all this research. And during that time, I actually taught preparation exams or taught trainers to prepare for the certified pet dog training knowledge assess exam, right? And so one of the things was really highlighting the importance of starting with management. And so if you think about the three rules for the house, if you think about a parent, I mean, parents don't let their two-year-old toddle throughout the house unwatched, right? And it's that same kind of thing when it comes to dogs. You know, the study that just came out about how dogs go through a similar adolescent phase where their hormones go out of whack and they just like human teenagers, they go through this phase where they just can't control themselves and they don't, it's almost like they literally lose their mind for a few months, right? Or a few weeks. And they have that very similar thing. The more that we research dogs, the more we realize the parallels in their developmental stages, even though they may go faster. And so if we can step back from this need of being the human who's controlling the animal, and instead looking at yourself as the individual who's negotiating a space and a relationship, everybody's rules are different, which is why when I would have people who said, I don't want my dog on the couch. And my first question would be like, do you not want your dog on the couch? Or did you grow up told dogs don't belong on the couch? Because those are two different questions. And so, yeah, I totally agree that a lot of it is about setting up the environment so that the dog knows what's expected, because then you can move more into where do you give, right? A loving parent isn't always stern with their child. They aren't afraid to get on the floor and roll around and giggle. They aren't afraid to build, you know, couch forts and tell crazy stories. But at the same time, they provide the boundaries to help the child grow up successful and understand what they need to do to navigate their world in a way that is appropriate and safe for everybody around them. And it's the same thing with dogs. It really is.
Yeah. And that also makes me think where some, and I don't know if you have done this already, but maybe a potential future area of research is, I'm kind of curious where if we're seeing these parenting styles that mimic, you know, human parenting and pet parenting. But if we look at pet parents who have these different styles and they like almost looking at what behavior issues or, you know, successes that these parenting styles have, for example, like I'm kind of curious in terms of like there are certain ones like the dog, like not because again, there's genetic input and there's environmental input and there's all kinds of things that play into behavior. But sometimes I do feel like there are some dogs where if they haven't been given, for example, enough, you know, so guidance, boundaries and rules, they can have lower impulse control or they don't deal with frustration as well. Mm-hmm. And then on the flip side, dogs who are just way too overmanaged and way too much control, you can kind of see like anxiety, like they're not quite sure what to do or and those types of things. So I feel like there, if we had the data, there has to be some sort of correlation between these parenting styles and certain behavior, and certain problem behaviors. But I don't know if you've looked at that or have you thought about it?
So here's the interesting thing. I ended up taking a little bit of a sidetrack because of finding this population of women who didn't have children. And so it led me in a little bit of a left turn during my graduate work. But when I was doing the research for my master's thesis and the background on these parenting styles, part of my driving factor was your question that you just asked. And so when I looked at it in the parenting literature, there is definitely an association in particularly adolescent development and its response to authoritative versus authoritarian parenting. And so when you get that authoritarian parenting of high control, low emotional warmth, especially if it goes in the direction of any sort of capital punishment or, you know, hitting those things, there is definitely outbursts related. There are declines in academic performance. There are issues solidifying good relationships with their peers, like healthy relationships with their peers. There are issues potentially with drug use. Sometimes we see earlier onset of sexual activity. Those kinds of things all play out. So there's that kind of combination of that adolescent loss of impulse control connected with a sense of not being, you know, think about when you were a high schooler, right? My parents don't understand me. Nobody understands me. Nobody's ever been through this before. They can't possibly know. And though they may not have it to the degree and the nuance that we do, dogs have a very similar, if there's not a good warm attachment between them and their owner and they start entering this kind of adolescent neurotic phase, it's going to have negative results for both sides. And that's one of the reasons that we see an increase in relinquishments to shelters during that 7 to 18 month period in dogs' lives.
Yeah. So with adolescents or even when people have puppies and they have their puppies at 2, 3, 4 months of age, one of the things I try to remind them over and over again is that you're as cool as you're ever going to be to your puppy right now. Because so when we're working on things like coming when called and listening and doing all these things, like once they hit, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 months, all of a sudden, like, yeah, coming back to mom and dad was really fun without food or whatever when they were young. But now, like, there's this, you know, really cute boy dog over there, really cute girl dog that they want to go see, or they have like their playmate or whatever. So it's just, you know, it is similar to, you know, to that. And I think that also has to play into the sort of the you know, if you're really, especially if, like, you know, having your dog listen well under different, in different places and contexts, you know, starting that work early, but knowing that once you get to their teenage years, you're going to see that. And some of that is very, very normal. Mm-hmm. And you can work through that. So I don't want people to feel like if they have their teenage puppy right now and they're not listening to them and kind of being, you know, I don't want to use a bad label, but, you know, quote, the term I hear a lot is like they're being bratty or whatever, which they're just being a dog and they're just an adolescent and they're trying to, you know, experience the world. But that's like super, super normal. So I thought that's a really good thing to touch on.
Yeah, it is super normal. And just like with any species, whether they be our human offspring or our dogs, understanding that that's coming and, you know, talking to somebody who's qualified to help you figure out how to get through it sanely and with your relationship intact. You know, when you get on the other side of that, and I'm speaking to you and other trainers who might be listening and people who've had multiple dogs in their lives, if you can get through the adolescent phase and get to the other side of it with a good relationship under your belt, the cruise control years are so great. They are so fun when you get into that stage where you kind of know each other and you get into a rhythm, right? And I get goosebumps just thinking about it, of what that can be like. So I definitely encourage anyone listening, if you're going through the teenage years of your dog, don't be afraid to reach out to somebody for the right assistance, right?
Yeah. And I think the other thing too, is sometimes people get dogs where, like, I hope you wouldn't do this with a kid. Although I think some people probably do it with sports and music where they're like, you know, I'm going to have a, you know, an NHL hockey player and you'll see with people with dogs where it's like, you know, I really want this agility dog or I want this scent detection dog or whatever. I think the other important thing to remember is, or like, I want a dog who likes all dogs and likes all people. Like, I think the other thing to kind of step back and remember is that, like, they are their own living beings, and our influence as a primate onto a canine, or like as a human onto a canine, is only going to be so great. And it's one of my biggest regrets early on, because I was really into like obedience and rally and doing these things where I felt like I did a lot of stuff with my dog, you know, this is over 10 years ago, but that, like, I don't know if he really enjoyed. And then, but like, he might've been more quote unquote trained, but it wasn't like, now I feel like with my dogs, they, like, their activities and their structure is more focused on them, mm-hmm. you know, and sort of like what they like. And there's a balance, because there's some stuff they have to do. But I think just in terms of parenting styles, like, if I think it's funny you mentioned all this, because you start thinking through, like, especially those of us who had multiple dogs, like, it's like, I'm sure people think about this with their kids too, but I'm like, my poor first dog had all these rules and, you know, it's like way over the top. And I thought, like, if he didn't listen to me in public, people were going to think I was a bad trainer. Oh, yeah. And like, and then now I just don't care, you know, as long as they're safe, and as long as they're safe and they're happy and they're not a menace to themselves, or they're not harming anyone else, or the, you know, society around them, they're good. But I think that's something else that I've learned over the years that I thought was important to share here, that I think just sort of taking a deep breath, relaxing, they are their own beings. Mm-hmm. And I think sort of enjoying the fact that they are, and that you can't have complete control over it, and sort of, you know, going where that journey takes you. And it will, you are right. Once you get through those teenage years, you know, you're going to enjoy those other years. And that also brings up a point where I'm a big proponent of adopting older dogs as well as an option for some people too, because you get to avoid the puppy years and the teenage years. You kind of know what you're getting. But I mean, it's fun to go through that as well. So
I have a good friend who's really big on, she likes to adopt the older dogs. She's got a thing. She wants to adopt the dogs that are 8, 9 years old. And I totally give her kudos for that, because I attach so deeply and so quickly. I don't think I could handle the emotional load of only getting a couple years with a dog at a time. Mm. And so I honestly don't find the teenage years nearly as frustrating. And that may be because I have enough knowledge of the literature and enough experience now, having, you know, I mean, I grew up on a small hobby farm, so there were always dogs and all these different things. And so for me, I find it amusing. And yeah, like you said, the first, and this is documented with parenting literature, the first child always is more structured. You're always more careful about who's washed their hands before they hold the baby, all those kinds of things. You think about, you know, the first puppy, you do not go out to socialize until your vet says it's okay. And now you reach a point where you're like, well, you know, a little in the right environment. It's like, I'm not going to take them out in the middle of the woods, and I'm not going to take them to the city dog park, but I'm not going to expect them to pee in this like 2 square foot area of the backyard, because I'm afraid if they venture out into other parts of the yard, they're going to get sick. So.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm wondering, like, did you see any, I don't know if you've looked at this, but has there been any difference between men and women with their pet parenting styles?
That was supposed to be part of my master's thesis. However, men tend not to want to answer surveys very well.
Okay.
Hal Herzog actually documented this in 2007, and we continue to try to figure out ways to get around this. If there's a survey that's open to both sexes or multiple genders, women will answer, men won't. Now, on an observational level, I know that myself and Karen London and a few other people have made observations in dog training classes or just out in the world. I have a paper that's in press right now, so it's not actually out yet, but we did go out to dog parks. I trained a group of undergraduate researchers who helped me collect data, and we went out to local dog parks, and we looked at just interactions, the frequencies of different types of interactions between women and men and their dogs. And one thing we did find, and this goes along with the evolutionary literature and the parenting literature, women are more likely to hug and kiss and baby talk. We use that motherese, oh, little baby boy, right? We do a lot more of that than men do. And interestingly enough, there is prior literature to suggest that men are less vocal when interacting with their dogs. They're more likely, if their dog gets upset, they're more likely to soothe with a solid, steady hand petting the back, or putting the arm, you know, putting their arm around the dog's shoulders until they can calm down. Whereas women tend to try to soothe vocally. And that is one of our evolutionary differences. Not to say that there aren't women who don't soothe by petting and not talking and all those different things, but on average, women are more likely to be vocal while petting their dog, whereas men are less.
Well, what's interesting about that is if we could survey dogs, which we can't, but
I'm working on that.
If we could, they would probably choose less hugging and kissing, also probably less verbal stuff, and probably more, like, I feel like a lot of dogs probably do better with tactile, although some definitely prefer to be kind of talked to softly and those types of things. But I find that interesting as well. So maybe with the hugging and kissing, I think, you know, you don't want to be doing that to like strange dogs, no. But I think most dogs tolerate it, or, you know, cause we're in their social group. So they're like, cause I hug and kiss my dogs all the time, uh-huh. But I find that funny. But then also just the, I guess it's sort of like, is that a difference in how men and women evolved, I guess, to like give feedback or like to, why are we seeing those differences, I guess, is my question.
There's definitely some literature to suggest that it's a difference in how we evolved our parenting strategies. By default, since the woman spends the time being pregnant, spends the time nursing, there's a lot more immediate, that direct care and touching and holding. There tends to be a little bit more of the verbal, because the idea is, you know, if you think about evolutionary past, you maybe had a fire, you're a small group, but there's predators around you. You didn't have houses with locked doors. So being able to easily and quickly calm the child, that's going to translate to our desire to quickly and easily calm and soothe our pets. Whereas with men, tended to be in that time, we're more involved in the indirect care, the hunting, the procurement, the defense, watching the perimeter, staying up as a sentinel while others slept in the camp, those types of things. And so that also then tends to translate into more of like the stoic father. And of course, you know, cultural expectations of masculinity and things play a role. So one of my colleagues did a study where they actually surveyed men about their willingness to convey their attachment to their dog, showing public expression to their dog, that kind of thing. And one of the things they found was that younger men who are more conscious of masculinity expectations would express in the survey how much they loved their dog, but would acknowledge they did not behave as such, especially if there were those around to view it. And that certainly played out in anecdotes with our study at the dog parks, where we had a hard time capturing it in the data, but a lot of the researchers would comment they expected men to be a lot more involved in displaying, look how well trained my dog is, look how well my dog listens, my dog doesn't even have to be on leash. And while it didn't get captured in the actual follows, side notes were made regularly about sitting outside of the off-leash dog runs with the dog off leash, walking the dog through different performative tasks to show how well the dog listened. Right. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things. So there's definitely some clear evolutionary components that were just, and even cultural components that are just driving those differences to display to each other. Because we know that even if the intention is to eventually have children, we know that people use their pets as a way of displaying their potential mate, especially men. And women tend to find men who are photographed with dogs more attractive. We tend to find pet owners more attractive. There's something in this like signal that there's a nurturing tendency there that we really like.
Yeah. And that's really cool. And so do we see this as well? Like, I know what I was going to say. So, you know, it's interesting too with these differences. And I think this is important, especially in households where there's, two pet parents or two guardians or whatever term you want to use, but especially if you kind of come at things quite differently, I do find it can create a lot of anxiety in the dog, because the predictability of the household and the rules and those types of things, they aren't predictable. And I think that, and sometimes we see that where it's like, so if people are listening and you feel like, you know, one of you is maybe a little too controlling, and then maybe one is a little too permissive. And I've seen this in every order, where sometimes it's the man, sometimes it's the woman, or sometimes it's two women or two men. That doesn't matter. But when that happens, you do have to agree on some sort of, you know, what the rules are. How are you going to keep things predictable. It doesn't mean you have to do everything exactly the same, but that's definitely one area where I've noticed problems, where things are so drastically different. It can not be good for the dog. I would assume for kids as well.
Oh yeah.
You know, so, but I think that if you are doing that, you know, it's one of the easy things I can think of, are like, what are the three rules, you know, mm-hmm. like what are the three things that they can't do? And then what are three things we're always going to reinforce? And keep things simple, but keep things predictable is super important.
Oh yeah. And I, this is one of those things that's totally from my gut. We don't have as much literature on it. But based on my experience as a trainer and the literature that I have read about the cognitive and emotional ability of dogs, I can totally see that dogs would learn to distinguish, just like children, which one's more permissive and how to get mm-hmm. away with things by asking, knowing who to ask and when to ask, right?
Oh, yeah.
There's always that one person, we call them the weak link, right? The one that's always going to give table scraps, no matter what the dietary restrictions are. Yep. And so those kinds of things they pick up on. We know that they can do things. So there was a study a few years back where they looked at the capacity for dogs to know if they're being watched when they steal food. And so what they found, they set up three different situations. There was a dark room, there was a researcher, a dog, and a treat in the middle of the room. And if the light was on the dog, they didn't steal the treat. If the light was on the treat, they didn't steal the treat. If the light was on the researcher and the dog and the treat were in the dark, but the dog could see the researcher, they almost always stole the treat. And that's very similar to the kid who kind of peeks around the corner of the kitchen to see if anybody's watching before they steal a cookie. I mean, so those kind of things we're not imagining. They are happening. We're just still catching up data-wise to capture it.
And I feel like almost everyone has had examples of like where like you left the house and you're like, oh, shoot, I forgot something, like my umbrella. And I'll walk back in and my dog's on top of the table, like something he would never do, right? Like, you know, it's you both got to look at each other and it's like, well, let's just forget this, you know? But
never happened.
I think that's really good. And then in terms of, I know you mentioned India, and I think you've looked at China and India as well. So are we, because I know you mentioned that this sort of Americanized version of dog ownership, but it sounds like some of this pet parenting is starting to happen in other places as well. What are some of the things we're learning there?
So we're definitely seeing it. And again, it's in cultures where there's fewer children. There's an increase in education. There's an increase in middle class. Japan has been really interesting to pay attention to. There hasn't been as much in the research, but paying attention to their media and some of the stories, some of the things that are happening. There's a phenomenon occurring, and I don't want to say this as a generalized like all Japanese, but there is a phenomenon occurring where women don't want to have children, even in marriage, because of the way that their labor market tends to not support women, right? And that's something that their prime minister has been trying to work on, and then everything has happened around the world. But so because of that, one of the defaults has been an increase in having dogs, right? And to the point of they have a lot of the same things we do as far as you can go to boutiques and you can get high-end foods and clothing and hats and bows and ribbons. And to some extent they make, I mean, sometimes they even put some of our best doggy boutiques to shame when you see some of these pictures, an increase in the doggy strollers and those types of things. But then there's some beneficial things too. So sometimes when your dog is aging, it becomes harder to take care of them, especially if you're trying to work, you know? And so you're seeing an increase in things like doggy hospice, where you can have somebody who comes take care of your dog when you have to be at work, or you have a place where your dog can stay during the week. Is that stressful for them? Maybe. From a physical perspective, though, if something were to happen to them, they're not home alone while you're working and that's happening. And then the other thing that we're seeing, too, is like in South Korea, as recently as 2009, there was a study done on people's perceptions of dogs and cats. And the fact that even though we were seeing more pet keeping in South Korea at the time, there was this very, the Confucian values of hierarchies and structures were still there, where one person might acknowledge that, yes, this is my pet, but they weren't willing to say others shouldn't be eating these species, right? Because you still had in some cases where you would see, especially in village areas, where you would see the consumption of dog and cat meat. That has changed rapidly. And in 2015, they actually passed legislation that you can no longer raise companion animals for the meat market. That doesn't mean that if you have some sort of ritualistic perspective or value that you're honoring, because we see this in cultures, even eating human ancestors, that you're somehow honoring them and consuming them after death. But doing so, you know, that still is a possibility in some of these cases. In China, one of the things that we're seeing is a drastic distinction between who is a pet and who is part of the food market. In China, it still has a tendency to be about smaller dogs, although there are definitely some cases of like German Shepherds and Chows. But it tends to be smaller dogs are more likely to be present in homes where there are either no children or the children have grown up and moved out. So one of my colleagues who does research, different topic in China, she looks at aging in China, and she commented on the fact that in the mornings in Beijing, you can walk around and you'll see all these older ladies with their little white fluffy dogs. And I just couldn't help but think about how that was a starting point here in the United States and where might their pet keeping and pet parenting culture go from there. So yeah, there's definitely some interesting cross-cultural things shifting. I have a colleague in South Africa who talks about the fact that she loves her dog to death, but will never have children. All these different things. And again, it seems to be in areas where there's that increase in educational attainment. Women have more reproductive autonomy. They may be having fewer or no children. I know some individuals who joke that they had the child first because otherwise they wouldn't be able to have both. And then they use the child as the excuse to get the pet, right? So those kinds of things happen too.
Yeah. And I do wonder too, because like it's almost like, and just from talking with people, like I feel like the pressures of, you know, now like financial pressures on young people, like it takes longer to kind of get your feet under you financially. So, you know, people with student loan debt or, you know, even just working your way up to get yourself to a position that's stable and you can do that. Like, I feel like there's, and especially in these urban areas where it's just really expensive, where like your apartments and your living is really expensive. So, you know, a dog can be kind of be that first step almost, you know. The other part of it is, this is the part I struggle with sometimes, and that's, you know, how beneficial is this for dogs? So obviously there's going to be certain benefits, like, you know, you don't have to worry about getting rabies or distemper or parvo, or, you know, if you break a limb, you get to go get, you know, as much you don't want to go to the vet, the outcome is surely much better than if you didn't. So there's those types of things. But then from like an autonomy perspective, you know, sometimes we get these dogs that come from these beaches in the Caribbean, or, you know, they might have been street dogs or whatever. And there's clearly some welfare drawbacks in terms of like the health stuff and, you know, having to find food and all those things. But on the other side, like they're able to decide what they want to do. So if they want to go out and find food, or they want to hang out, or they want to go find a mate, like they have those. They have that. And we think about our dogs, like we're castrating them, mm-hmm. or spaying them sometimes at super young age and kind of depriving them of that. They really don't get to choose when they come and go. I mean, when they eat, when they go for walks, it's all chosen by someone else. And lots of dogs have great lives. And I think my dogs do as well. But the part that sort of hits me sometimes is this sort of treating them as part of her family, and obviously it has lots of pros, but there are some drawbacks with that. So I'm just kind of curious, like, have you thought about that as well? And sort of that, it just feels like a little complicated. So, you know, I'm not saying I would change it and say dogs shouldn't be in our families, because I'm obviously not saying that, but maybe there's things we should be aware of so we can make the lives of our dogs who are with us more fulfilling for them.
Yeah. I do think about that, especially as I get deeper into some of this literature and thinking about what makes a good parent, what makes a bad, quote, bad parent, all these different kinds of things. And are we, in fact, offering that to our dogs? I know that there's been some books written. So Jessica Pierce wrote a great book called Run, Spot, Run that gets into the philosophy of pet keeping and really kind of delves into this question, like, why do we keep animals in our homes? What are the pros and cons? Are we potentially, you know, rather than living in a commensal mutual relationship, are we somehow, you know, parasites on their attention and love and all these kinds of things? And so for me, I think the big part is, this is one of the reasons that I'm such a proponent of negotiating a relationship and realizing that it's not just an animal. It's not a thing that you program with a set of cues that is meant to respond immediately. It's not a robot, right? It's not a computer software. But rather seeing our dogs as he's and she's, and seeing them as individual personalities, which, you know, Greg Burns at Emory has done some great stuff with his neuroscience research. And he's a big proponent of the fact that he has this assortment of pet dogs of various different breeds and backgrounds, because he's looking at what are the differences in their individual behavior and how that comes through in their neuroscience and their MRIs, as opposed to other researchers who are doing additionally great work with MRIs, and they're trying to control those variations by making sure that they're using all of one breed in a certain age cohort and those kinds of things. So knowing that we have the literature, that you're not imagining it when your dog has a different personality. A good trainer friend of mine, so shout out Deb if you're listening. She has an Airedale Terrier, and I swear to God, this dog is the least terrier dog you will ever meet. She's just, I've loved her. I've known her since she was a puppy, and I just love her. And so those kinds of things, right, all play a role. And being aware of, like you said earlier, just because you got a border collie to do agility does not mean that that dog's necessarily going to want to do agility. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you should be starting agility young because, oh, you've got to shape them while they're mentally plastic or whatever, because there's potential health issues of starting certain dog sports too young. You know, the bones and the joints haven't fused. You've got floating bone caps and all these things while they're growing. And I do think also a lot about the spay-neuter issue. The more, you know, as a trainer, when I was still living in Las Vegas, and I would see the number of dogs that, you know, the unwanted dogs in the shelters full and all those kinds of things. And I'm sure you see that in New York too. I'm sure if I were to go to the shelters here in Boise, I would see the same thing. And so there's that part of me that says, you know, we do have to control overpopulation, et cetera, et cetera. But then there's that other part of me that knows a lot about physiology and the importance of hormones in growth and development, and not just reproduction, right? We know that in mammalian bodies, estrogen has potential lifelong benefits to cognitive decline and helping stave off, you know, Alzheimer's and all these things in humans. So what are we potentially doing to our dogs when we cut off their estrogen supply at 3 and 4 months old? The influence of testosterone on developing, and in both male and female bodies, the influence of testosterone in developing immune systems. And I think that we solved a problem for us kind of ahead of the game, right? It became easier to take your dog to the dog park if you didn't have to know if she was in heat, those kinds of things. But yeah, on the flip side, if we really do love our dogs as members of our family, it might be time to start thinking a little bit broader about what are we willing to do? What responsibility are we willing to take in helping manage their life during certain, you know, for a female dog, it's like 3 weeks twice a year. With male dogs, it's a little bit more effort and work, but just because they don't smell male to another male doesn't mean that they don't still have some of their own behavioral tendencies as a male, right? Just because you remove the testosterone doesn't immediately, that old myth of, oh, you neuter a dog and they won't be aggressive. And I'm like, oh, that's so not true. Right.
Yeah. I actually find with the new, it's actually that sometimes they just bring attention onto themselves because they're so novel, especially when you're in like place like New York City, you go into a dog park, like all the dogs are spayed neutered. Mm-hmm. So you have a dog who's intact. There's a lot of interest there. And sometimes that, you know, might cause things, but yes, you're right. I mean, by and large, even at our facility, we have intact males and females all the time, and it's fine, you know? Yeah.
Well, and two, you know, like with the intact male thing, especially when you connect it to something like early spay and neuter, my heart dog, so we lost him about a year and a half ago now. And so, but he's, you know, they never go away. but mm-hmm. I think about the fact that when we got him, it would be like 15 years ago now, we got him at 9 weeks and he was already neutered. Right. And with that came a life of wondering every time he went to the vet's office, if his excessive fear and drooling and anal expression and all these things that came with going to the vet had anything to do with that happening during a potential fear imprint period, right? The more that we learn, the more responsibility we have to take that knowledge into consideration. The tricky part is when you're thinking about policies and legislation and things like spay-neuter laws and pet population controls, you can't necessarily assume that everybody is going to be a highly educated, invested owner. There are going to still be people who their reason to not neuter their pet is an extension of their own masculinity. And, oh, by the way, I let my pet run the neighborhood. So you still have, I mean, there's never an easy answer. And that's always the downside. And I think, you know, we could talk about the ethics of how we're influencing their welfare and things like that, keeping them where they can't control, you know, like controlling their comings and goings. But on the flip side, I think that we do that with each other enough too. To some extent more. Right. I mean, you don't let your 5-year-old walk out the front door and walk down to the convenience store. Like, you just don't.
Yeah.
So
yeah, you don't.
The unfortunate part is, from the dog's perspective, they're not 5. Even though we may view them as being 4 or 5 years old their whole life, they're not. You know. So.
No. Yeah, and sometimes I feel like too. Even with that, I feel like, when I think about, like, yeah, how much am I controlling their lives and doing all this? One of the things that I've noticed over the years with my dogs and other dogs that I would say, I think the biggest welfare issue, I shouldn't say the biggest, one of the biggest welfare issues in our society is, like, isolation and time alone.
Oh, yeah.
Because I feel like if your dog is with you, or, you know, especially if your dog is social, if they're with you or if they're somewhere where they don't always have to be alone, I think that's probably something they would choose almost over anything else. Like, I think a lot of other stuff, they're willing to take that bargain of, I get food, but you choose when I go for a walk. But I feel like that time left alone can be really challenging and real detrimental for some dogs, where like, again, you wouldn't leave a 5-year-old kid at home by themselves all day. And that doesn't mean, I leave my dogs at home by themselves and they're okay with it for 2 to 3 hour periods. But it's just sort of like, I do feel like that's one area we need to pay more attention to, and thinking through how we best manage that. But, you know, just not expecting them to be there on evenings and weekends, because, you know, it's the whole life that they're living while we are at work. And thankfully, I think people are becoming more aware of that, because people have dog walkers now and daycare for dogs who are appropriate. And for anyone listening, some dogs aren't appropriate for daycare and would choose to stay home too. So I think this is like a very large, it depends, but yeah, you really have to think about that. And for anyone kind of worried about the spaying and neutering, and they're thinking about rescuing a dog and those types of things, you know, if you get a dog from a breeder, it's a little bit easier to make that choice sometimes, although some breeders want you to do it earlier. But there are more, I think, breeders and rescues where you can like do a deposit where you might spay or neuter them at like 2 or 3 years of age, and then you get your deposit back. I mean, I don't know how fair that is, because not everyone can afford to put up like a $500 or $1,000 deposit. But I'm with you in terms of with my dog Joey, who was neutered at, I think, between 12 and 16 weeks, and he's very slender. And a lot of times when dogs come in and they're a pediatric neuter, we can kind of see that, and he's having a great life. But I don't know how that's going to affect him in his later years. So yeah, it's something that crosses my mind too. And it's just, yeah, it's a complicated issue.
There's been some studies looking at the result, the long-term developmental result. And yeah, you can usually, especially for the males, pediatric neuters, you can usually see, because their back end seems to be taller than their shoulders, instead of having a nice straight back line, right? They tend to be a little less on the muscular side. They tend to develop more likely to develop obesity, and it tends to develop earlier if it's going to come, those kinds of things. So there are definitely some things outside of the behavior perspective. I also often think about the fact that, like you're saying, that dogs aren't just there for nights and weekends. And one thing that always surprises me is how frequently, and this is probably changing. It was starting to change when I was still training. But the idea that dogs need stimulation, that they need species appropriate and individual appropriate interactions and play, chewing outlets, and all those things we often talk about. That's not just for when they're teething. That is something they need their whole lives. Some dogs are not meant for the dog park, and they may have a really extroverted owner who wants to go to the dog park, because let's be honest, you go to the dog park, you get to sit around drinking coffee and talking about dogs with other people while you watch dogs play. I mean, the dog park is a blast. Mm-hmm. But for, right. but for some dogs, it's just not the right space. They may be a little bit more on the sensitive end. They may be a little less. I make the comments based upon our pug that I truly, there's a part of me that truly thinks that we're going to find that there's something akin to autism in our dogs. She is not really good with other dogs. She's had just one too many experiences of a dog rushing her off leash while she's on her leash. And we all know how that sets things up. But also, she just doesn't seem to read other dogs very well. She loves people. Like if I could take her to the park, I mean, take her to the park for people, she'd probably be a great therapy dog, as long as there weren't other dogs around. So awareness of those individual personalities too. But I mean, some dogs need to scavenge for their food. They don't want to be fed. I always think of the Jurassic Park moment, like T-Rex wants to hunt. And so those kinds of things, being aware and just increasing and sharing that awareness with others. You find out if a coworker is getting a new dog, like, oh, you know, you should really pay attention to whether or not they maybe would do really well with a tricky treat ball or a stuffed Kong and all these different things that we can bring up in casual conversation and help feed the network of knowledge to others around us can be really helpful too.
Yeah. And we have, I'll put a link to the books that you mentioned. I'll also put a link to where we have a free online course for canine enrichment. So I'll post a link to that too, because yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think the areas that we can really focus on are things like, yeah, feeding, like some dogs like to forage for their food or like do them in feeding toys because they just prefer that. And what's really interesting about this is a lot of pet owners aren't familiar with the concept of like contra freeloading, but like you could put like a bowl of food down and you could put like a food puzzle down. You think they're going to eat the food bowl, but they'll go for that toy and they'll work at, you know, because it's just such a internally driven behavior for some dogs. And even on walks, like it's like making sure you give time for them to sniff and do things, not just sort of like it's a, you know, like a military walk just to get an exercise. And there's some dogs where you need to just give them exercise and you're going out on a run and that's what you do. But for many dogs, like making that a time where they actually do have freedom and to kind of sniff and do those things. And if they do like running and sprinting, maybe agility is good. Or if you have terriers, maybe there's, like lure coursing or, you know, there's all kinds of really neat sports or activities that you can do, but I'm a pretty big proponent of, you know, finding something that your dog actually enjoys. And it has to be something you both enjoy because it's going to be a lot more fun that way.
Absolutely.
And if you do find those activities, it can be a really great experience. So, yeah, that's awesome.
With our little beagle mix, I learned how to do nose work. And for a while I was running nose work classes. And it always was fun to me too, thinking about different types of stimulation. Because I would have people come to me like, oh, I don't know about taking this nose class. I mean, you're telling me it's going to tire my dog out, but my dog hikes with me five miles, 5 days a week, or blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh, just bring him the first day and let's see what happens. And the second week I always, oh my God, it was so great. They slept the whole afternoon, right? Because it's a different type of stimulation. And that's the other thing too, is making sure we're varying how we're interacting and providing them these outlets. If you're going to list books, I have to plug one of my favorite people because she basically wrote the book that I would probably have ended up writing if she hadn't. So Alexander Horowitz, any of her stuff is great, but I highly recommend Our Dogs Ourselves. I know that came out last year. And there's so much in it that there were so many yes, yes, yes kind of moments as I was reading that book. Just thinking about you, like the question about our historical stuff, where did we come up with collars and why do we use collars and how do we come up with our names? And then there's a great chapter that fleshes out some of the spay neuter conversation too. So,
yeah, she's great. And I was very lucky because back when I was doing my master's in animal behavior, she came and did a guest lecture.
Nice.
And she's, she's sharp. That's probably the best way to put it. And she really knows her stuff. So definitely, definitely check that out. I know she has some, and then she's on Twitter too. So I'll put her Twitter handle out there.
I get a lot of people who ask me like, if I want to get involved in our relationship with our pets, what's the first thing I should read? And now that Our Dogs Ourselves is out, it's usually one of the first books I recommend. So.
Yeah, that's great. I haven't read that one yet. I've read some of her other books. So maybe I'll have to read that one because I know the other end of the leash, which I know is like 17 years old now, was also one where it's a little, I think for the average pet owner, it's like a really nice sort of like, it kind of gets into some of this stuff. But
Richard
it'd be
McConnell
nice.
Talks about things like, why does your dog roll and that nasty stuff?
Exactly. Yeah. So that was always kind of my go-to. So I'll have to read this, you know, for pet owners. But I think sort of like to kind of wrap up the conversation with this, is I think the good news about all of this is people do this stuff because they care. So I think like for the vast majority of people, the intent is really good. And I think that the longer I do this and the more owners I work with, the more and more you just see like people really love their dogs. So, and you know, there's people are willing to learn and they're going to school, you know, they're taking training and they're doing enrichment and doing all these things. So I think overall, I think hopefully we keep heading in a direction where we keep thinking about these things. And because even if you think now, like I think back to when I grew up, like most people didn't walk their dogs. Like I grew up in Nova Scotia. I mean, like I remember I was bit as a kid, so I was actually fearful of dogs, but dogs used to follow us down to the baseball field or to the pond where we played ice hockey and be like out on the pond with us. And like we had friends' dogs where they just be gone all day and then they come home, you know? Yeah. So maybe they probably had a great day, but I mean, but also there was like dogs getting hit by cars and there was like dog bites and there's all kinds of other things that go along with that. But now like you see like people walk their dogs and they do enrichment stuff and all these things. So I think overall, I think that's the great thing about this is people are becoming more aware of it. And I also think dogs are kind of like this for a lot of us in these urban places. You know, it's urban and suburban for sure. It's kind of like our last connection to the natural world, like outside of other humans, you know? And so we don't really have access, you know, a lot of people don't like see where their food comes from or if they do eat meat, sort of see like, you know, cattle or, you know, dairy cows or chickens, even like having interacted, you know, because even if you do eat meat, you interact with these animals. It's like, they're a lot like dogs in a lot of ways. And I think just sort of having that into, you know, interacting with a species that's not our own is I think one of the benefits that I hope will kind of, it'll impact more than just humans and dogs. And I kind of feel like, you know, I do this thought experiment where if we didn't have dogs, like what would our society be like? And obviously there's places that don't have pet dogs, but if I think about like our, you know, North American society, it's like a little sad. So.
Well, and kind of to your point about how they keep us connected to our natural world. I mean, think about if you have a cat and I don't want to get a whole bunch of angry tweets from the cat people, but if you have a cat and you tend to keep your cat indoor, which I think it's great that more and more people are building like outdoor enclosures for their cats and stuff.
Catios.
Yeah. Right. So if you have a cat though, the probability is that you aren't teaching your cat to walk on leash. You're not spending a lot of time outside with your cat. You may be a personality who just inherently leans towards being indoors more. If you have a dog, not only does the dog themselves represent part of our kind of nature, you know, domestic wild dichotomy and all that kind of stuff, but they get us out into the green spaces, the hiking trails. Mm-hmm. They get us out to the park and by the lake. Especially the more we invest in them and the more we want to see them open up in their own personalities and giving them time to sniff and smell their world, remembering that they are olfactory animals. And so asking your dog to walk out, go for a walk without stopping to smell is like asking you to go out with your eyes closed, right? Yep. And so with that kind of thing in mind, they also invite us to engage in parts of the world that we often ignore. Maybe our head is in our cell phone, that kind of thing. And I really think it's sad when I see people at the park on their cell phone and their dog is just kind of haphazardly attached to their arm, because it's sad for the person, all the things they're missing out on by not exploring with their dog. And so those all become part of it too. And when I see the increase, people willing to spend more money on getting qualified trainers and spending the time working through things like separation anxiety, people who want to invest in the puzzle toys and all this, to me, that really is a reflection of this increased application of parenting strategies. Because not only are you investing more time, you're investing more emotion, and you're investing more financial. You know, and that's a reflection of how we have grown as a parent society and how we are now doing that more and more with other species, either because we're raising one child and one dog and they're both the puppies, or because we're raising just the puppies.
So. Yep. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, just fascinating research, really timely. And hopefully, I'm looking forward to reading your future work. If people wanted to follow you, where's the best place to do that?
Best place to do that is on Twitter. My handle is at ShellyVPhD. I wish I had something more creative, but that's what I came up with right after my dissertation because I was like so excited to get my doctorate. So, and I am on there fairly regularly. So I do engage and you'll find me having conversations with Sarah and with Alexander and other people pretty regularly too. So,
yeah. So highly recommend. Also, I'll put that in the episode notes. And my last question that I ask every guest, which is, it doesn't have to be related to this topic, but just sort of based on all your experience of both, because you what's nice is you were a trainer and then you got into research. But if you had to boil down like one piece of advice for pet owners based on all that you've learned, what is it?
Other species, and especially the ones that we have domesticated and evolved with, so our dogs and cats, they are living, breathing, emotional, thinking beings. And if we're going to invite them into our homes and if we're going to make them part of our lives, then seeing that as a negotiated attachment of give and take and working together like any other relationship, whether it's your children or your spouse or your friends, that's really crucial to their welfare as well as our own.
Yeah, that's really well
Thank
said.
You. I have my moments.
Well, awesome. Well, thank you very much. That was great. And hopefully we'll have you back again.
Great. That'd be great. Thank you for having me.